All right, so what was so special about the teaching of Jesus? I'll tell you what was special about it. Jesus knows you better than anybody else. He knows us from the inside out. And I've often said that if you take a Christian and turn him inside out, you should find the same thing on the inside as there is on the outside. You know, there's facade everywhere around us. You know, politics and all, you know, you wonder, does anybody tell the truth to anybody anymore? You wonder about that, you know. Why doesn't somebody just be the same on the inside as they are the outside? So, Joyce and I hadn't been married very long. And there was, we had some of the Dunlaps. We had a wonderful time eating with them today, by the way. And we love you people very much. And it happens to be that they have that Andrea and her husband are from Spring Hill, Tennessee. So we went to this place. His name is Chester. Okay, that's Andrea's husband. Or from Spring Hill, Tennessee. I was trying to think of his name. Okay, and so we went there because there was this Friday night auction. We didn't have kids. We went to this auction, and I bought, you know, it was toward the end of the auction sale and stuff, and I bought this thing that looked like an old grand piano. And they were kind of rectangular. They weren't shaped like they are today. And I said, man, that is cherry. Look at that. That's wonderful. I bought that thing. It should have occurred to me that since I paid, you know, $70 or so for it, that maybe it wasn't exactly what it looked like. And it weighed like 1,000,000 pounds, but it was made of veneer. Oh, don't you hate veneer? Because it's got this nice-looking wood on the outside, and then when you start finishing it, there's this uglier wood on the inside. And you look carefully, you can see some places where the veneer has kind of worked through. You know, and that's kind of like a lot of Christians. You know, they got this surface thing going on. By the way, a good veneer is maybe 1/16 of an inch thick. Okay, it's got this surface thing going on, and when you rub through that, what do you have? You got that other stuff, that ugly stuff, that pressed wood, or, you know, that cheaper wood that's under there, the pine or something else. It looked like it was cherry. Well, it wasn't. Well, I still made a desk out of it and sold it for more than never mind. Okay, so the point is that it just wasn't what I thought it was. Now, Jesus knows that we have a tendency to be this way. And that is, kind of apply what I say on the outside, but don't let it go right down into the heart. And so, what we're going to be talking about tonight has to do with the Beatitudes. But the Beatitudes are deeper than things that just make you happy. I don't have any idea what just happened. I pressed it once, and it went 16 times. But here's what we've been doing. Why Jesus and his church, Jesus and the Old Testament, Jesus and his personal ministry. This morning we did Jesus my salvation. Next Sunday, Lord willing, we'll be doing Jesus and my life. All right, but tonight it's going to be Jesus and his personal ministry. Well, how are we going to do that? Because 3.5 years, and y'all are hoping you won't be here that long. Okay, so how are we going to do, and besides that, his personal ministry is probably 100 days or so. This is an estimate. Nobody can prove this. But the personal ministry that you read about in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John is probably 100 days in his personal ministry. In other words, you know, you can't look at everything, because even John said, why, if I wrote everything that Jesus did and said, the whole world would not contain the books in John 21. So, we can't do that tonight. But what we can do instead is look at something that would be easy to overlook, and that would be the first part of the Sermon on the Mount. So, let's talk about the coming of Jesus. Now, unless, you know, a doctor gets involved with a C-section, babies come when babies want to come. You know, and that's the way it's going to be. In other words, you can kind of say, well, what I want to do is I want to take a ride on a bumpy road. Well, do that if you want to, if it makes you feel better. Or you can eat, you know, watermelon or something. Whatever it is you've heard will help that baby to come. But the fact of the matter is, the baby comes when the baby wants to come, and Jesus came into the world at exactly the time that God wanted him. In other words, this is the way that it was planned before the foundation of the world, 1 Peter 1:18-20. Ephesians 3, it was in the manifold wisdom of God, verses 9-11. And in Ephesians 1 and verse 10, it was something that was set into place before the world began. Having looked at all that, then, let's look at Galatians 4 and verse 4. And notice the phrase in Galatians 4 and verse 4, when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son. So when did Jesus come into the world? When everything was right. Now, you can read other books out there about the number of things that were right about it. You know, you can read about the roads of the Roman system that was good for communicating, for, you know, transporting the gospel from one place to another. You can read about the water duct system. You can read about Greek being the universal language. You can read about this and you can read about that. But the bottom line is that God came when it was supposed to happen. God came at the fullness of time, just like a woman, and the analogy, by the way, is a woman being pregnant. And whenever the baby, whenever she is really, really ready to come, that is the fullness of time when that baby is going to be born. I mean, the fullness of time. Therefore, that means that's when Jesus is going to come. Now, when he's going to come, what's he going to do? Well, he's going to see some things that he doesn't want to see. In Matthew 23, he's going to weep over some things. And I'm sure that he laughed because sometimes he told some humorous things. But certainly he didn't like it in Matthew 23 because, you see, there had been other prophets sent before him and they killed all of them. And by the way, I would like to, you know, when I worked with him growing up from the time that I was 9 to the time that I was about 18 in the summertime. And so one of the things that I had heard was matter than old wet hen. Well, my dad and I and another guy was replacing the porch. Unfortunately, there was no setting hen on the porch. And every time we'd shoo her off and she'd come back, we'd shoo her off, we'd come back. Now, I'd heard that expression, matter than a wet hen, so I got a water hose and I wet her down. Okay, and I was just thinking somehow or another, you know, she wasn't happy about it, but she still came back. Okay, so the thing is that Jesus said, I wanted to gather you under my wings like a mother hen would gather her chickens under her wings, but you would not. I wanted to do that at the end of his personal ministry. So let's talk then about the fact that this Jesus now is going to tell us how that we should live our lives from the inside out. Now, there's another account in Luke 6. It might not be the Sermon on the Mount because it talks about there being a flat place. There could have been a flat place at the top of the hill. So Luke 6 and Matthew 5, 6, and 7 could be the same sermon. Luke 6 is a lot shorter, but probably, let's just say that Matthew 5, 6, and 7 is going to be a different sermon from Luke 6. It could very well be. Now, another thing, I'm standing up here. Why? Because that's what I've been taught I was supposed to do. In other words, why? Well, because preachers stand. But Jesus, when he preached, what did he do? He sat down. In our Bible class this morning, we saw something different. In Luke chapter 4, when Jesus went to Nazareth, when he read the scripture, he stood up. He stood up to read the word of God. He sat down to preach. Okay, and so what's that tell you? It's cultural. It is just flat cultural with regard to posture and how you preach. So we're generally used to people standing in the front, so here I am standing. But the Sermon on the Mount is significant because of a number of things. I don't know if that's the place where it was. This is the traditional Sermon on the Mount. Last time we were there in 1995, we went to this place, and they said, well, this probably is Sermon on the Mount of the Beatitudes, and I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, no. Okay, but anyway, this is like one of those things that they do for tourists. And so, there you go. I like charging $20 for pork chops at Patty's. No, just kidding. Okay, and so then in Matthew chapter, okay, Matthew, and by the way, it was worth it. It was good. All right, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, it contains the largest single block of Jesus' moral and ethical teaching that is contained in the New Testament. Now, a couple of words. Ethics. What is ethics? It means of the people. Of the people. He's telling the people how to live, giving us his ethics. Number two, morality. Moral. Another word, not like ethics, that's a Greek word, but now the word more, and that's a French word. Okay, and that's, you look at it and it looks just like mores in English, but when it's in the context, it means mores. Meaning, this is the way, Marlon, we're supposed to live. This is the way he wants us to live. Well, why don't we live this way? Well, brain damage. I don't know why we don't live this way, because it's difficult to live this way sometimes. That's why. So he's going to tell us about a new way, is a higher way. And you're going to have to stretch yourself. I'm going to have to stretch myself to live this way. Even though you may have known the Beatitudes your whole life, I bet you haven't thought about how difficult it is to do these things until you're in a situation where you need to do it and you find out how difficult it is. In other words, stretch yourself and think about, now let's think about the new way. What about the new way? Blessed are the Makarios. That doesn't really mean happy. We sometimes call these happitudes. But happy is overused now and then, and you know, why? Because, well, I just want somebody to make me happy. Nobody can make you happy. My wife can't make me happy, and I can't make her happy. What does that mean? Well, that means she can do things that are likely to make me happy. If I don't want to be happy, well, then I'm just not going to be happy, you know, and vice versa. Happiness is something, therefore, that if you try to go after it directly, it will be difficult for you to accomplish. In other words, it's best done while you're looking somewhere else, busy serving God. And then somebody says, are you happy? You know, I guess I am. I guess I am happy. In other words, this is what I want to do. And, you know, let me just tell you that I love Fred Hartman. I love teaching young people, and I love being with them and the places that, you know, that we've been asked to come in the past. The next question is going to be, well, where are the college students? You know, what can I do with college students? Because I'm just going to tell you, that makes me happy. After 30 years, I'm still as happy doing it as I was. But it's not because I just said, man, today I got to make myself happy. That doesn't work. Happiness, therefore, is more like an inner contentment, a peace of mind that comes from doing the right things and is generally best accomplished when you're not looking at it. And when you're not trying to do that, I'm going to do things that only those things that will make me happy. Well, then before you do it, somebody's got to cook breakfast. Before you know it, somebody's got to do something that might not necessarily make you happy. So to say that they're happy kids is a little bit misrepresentative, but it's on the right track. In other words, it does have something to do with this is the way that he wants us to live. Now, another point. What are the most lasting changes? Well, you might notice that I don't weigh 175 pounds. My left leg weighs 175 pounds. In my mind, sometimes I weigh 175 pounds. You know, until I look in the mirror, and then I don't. Okay, and then I'm thinking, well, what I want to do is, you know, so-and-so and so-and-so. And remember what I told you. Some of you skinny people really tick me off. Why? Because a skinny person will say this to you. Well, it's easy to lose weight. You just exercise more and eat less. And I'm thinking, will you go over that one more time, please? Okay, now, what are those 2 points again? Okay, so what is it about the exercise and about the eating less? Is that what you're telling me? Oh, I see. What I want is like one of those magic pills that you can take, you know, and just take it right before you go to bed. And then 35 pounds later, you wake up next morning. Boom, and you've lost 35 pounds. You know, the only way that I can lose 35 pounds overnight is if somebody cut off my head. And so I'm thinking, is there an easy way to do this? No, there's not an easy way to do this. And part of the problem with diets is you get back to reality and you're back to where you were, except maybe larger. Okay, so you lost some weight and you get back, and why? Well, there's this, you know, bouncing thing about going big and little and big and little and that sort of stuff. Well, let me just tell you, that doesn't work mainly because I haven't changed the way I'm thinking. And besides that, you guys take us to eat at the Majestic and the Cactus and the whatever and this and this. And we love it. And I'm thinking, well, I don't want these brethren to not get their money's worth, so I've got to eat well. Okay, and so, you know, so that's part of the deal with this. But I haven't really changed here. The most lasting change is going to be not modifying somebody's behavior. You can modify a kid's behavior. You know, you're bigger than they are. I'm from the generation when mom and dad knew how to modify behavior because spanking was perfectly okay. And let me just tell you, my mother never had any problem trying to figure out how to modify Ralph's behavior. My dad didn't have a problem with that because you can modify behavior, you know, but that like that child that was made to sit in the corner in the classroom, and his teacher said, you go over and stand with your face in that corner or you sit down in that chair in that corner until I tell you to get up. And you have your face to that wall. Sit down in that chair. Well, he was over there, and he's mumbling to himself the whole time. I might be sitting down on the outside, but on the inside, I'm standing up. Okay, and so that's part of the problem. We don't want to do certain things, and it doesn't matter if Jesus or anybody else tells us, we don't want that. Therefore, the problem is, I have come to conclude that I never really, you know, did a lot of behavioral stuff with my children. I think my wife and I did a good job with raising our 4 daughters. Most of the time, we feel like we did. There have been times that we were sure that we didn't. You know, we told you about one of our children, and they all have struggles all the time, don't they? They all have struggles of some kind or another, and you wonder, did I do a credible job? Well, I used to think I could make them mind when they were little. I can make that child mind. You know, if there's a child that's throwing a hissy in Walmart, let me just say to you, if you let me have that child for 5 minutes, I can make that child mind. You know, and you really don't have to go through Walmart for 30 minutes wondering, what is my child going to tear up next? Because when I was a boy, mother and daddy knew how to do that. Well, let me tell you what didn't work when I was a boy. When I was a boy, yes, they could modify my behavior, but by spanking me, they could not change the way I thought. Why? Because when I was 15 and 16 and 17 years old, I could show them that they didn't change my thinking. Why? Because I can do something to embarrass you if I want. And I can do something to hurt you if I want. And if I want to, I can do something to really tell the world that I'm not happy with the way that you brought me up. I can do that if I want. Why? Because you cannot control the thinking of your children. You can have some control over their environment. You have some control over their behavior. You have virtually no control over their thinking. So over the years, I've come to understand that as a parent, I control behavior a lot. I don't know how much behavior I really modified. I don't know how much there really was. I guess they're, you know, the girls love their mother. That's a good thing. I guess they love me too. But the point is that Jesus knows that if he's going to make disciples out of us, it is not about behavior modification. It is about changing the way you think. How do you think? If we can change the way that you think, then it will take care of itself. If your thinking hasn't changed, then the same old behavior patterns are going to come back again and again and again. And so Jesus says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Poor in spirit does not mean bad self-image. It does not mean I do not feel good about who I am, and the reason why I'm so subject to sin is because I want to be like the people around me. And whenever they tell me to, you know, go to a kegger, I'll go to a kegger. That's a drinking party. Or whenever I go, you know, try this, I'll try that. And they tell, hey, try this, and I'll try that. Doesn't matter what. And why do I do that? A lot of kids do that because they don't feel good about who they are. And when you don't feel good about who you are, you have difficulty saying no to people who do feel good about who they are. I have noticed at Fried Hardeman over the years, I don't know what the estimates would be, Gene, but I'm fully convinced that there are a lot of young men at Fried Hardeman who really struggle because they don't have a good relationship with their father. And I know there are some young women at Fried Hardeman who struggle because they don't have a good relationship with their mother. And maybe vice versa. But it is the root of a lot of times our kids getting into trouble is because they are not secure in who they are. They've been made to go to church, but they haven't thought through a lot of these things for themselves. They haven't owned their behavior. They haven't owned their faith. And because of that, that's part of the problem. Well, what does this mean? Poor in spirit doesn't mean poor self-image. What does it mean? It does mean I am ready for you to teach me. I am teachable. I am docile. I am a person who's ready to learn. Now, over the years, I've had some really good students. And I'll tell you this about Brian Mitchell. He's one of the best students that I've had at the graduate level. He went to Heritage, I believe. But as far as his graduate work is concerned, his graduate work is superlative. I like his attitude. I've never heard him preach one time, and I don't know his why. So if you understand what I just said, what I said to you is I am impressed with what I know about Brian Mitchell. Okay, now having said that, let's go back to this point. Why? Because there are some people that you can teach in the classroom, and there are some people that you can't teach. Why? They know more than you. And because they, that's a step there. And because they know more than you, the problem is they can't teach them. Why? Well, because I'm already smarter than you. So you get a freshman in your class. I'm speaking to the freshman tomorrow night at 10:30. Which I'm getting too old to do. But I'm speaking to the freshman tomorrow night at 10:30, and so I'm talking to a bunch of guys that are going to be fresh on campus, and everything is new, and the upperclassmen are going to be saying, yeah, there's a freshman. Okay, and so they're going to be there, and so it's all going to be new and stuff and everything. So I've been on the line looking, what is it that freshmen need to hear? So I've been doing some researching at what the six biggest problems are, freshmen, etc. But one of the things that's going to be really important to them is, are you here because you just want to get a piece of paper, or you want to learn? Okay, if you want to learn, I can deal with you. Even if you think that you're smarter than I am, or even if you are smarter than I can deal with you if you want to learn. If, on the other hand, you step in that classroom and you don't, I cannot help you. Why? Because I don't care how good I am as a teacher, until you get your attitude straight, I cannot help you. Therefore, the point is, blessed are the poor in spirit. That is the place where Jesus starts. That's the place where Jesus needs to start. If you want to be his disciple, you've got to be willing to learn. And you've got to be willing to practice what he says, or else it's not going to happen. Number two, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. But I'm not supposed to do that. Why? I'm a guy. Being a guy, I don't mourn. Why? Well, why in the world would you want to take your wife to a chick flick? You know, or for that matter, a girl that you're dating. That's a girl movie, for those of you who need some interpretation. Okay, but why in the world would you take them to a chick flick? Because you know somebody's going to have to cry at the end of this movie. And men just don't know how to do this. You know, when I went to Freed Hardeman, my dad, I lived 110 miles away from Freed Hardeman. And to me, it was like the end of the world. I mean, the other side of the world. I had never been. I tell you, I didn't even spend the night away from home. I was home most of the time. So the first weekend after being at Freed Hardeman, I was there a whole week and came back. And of course, I had some dirty clothes. And of course, the way my mother's cooking. And of course, you know, I was looking forward to that. So came on Friday evening, drove to Mount Pleasant, Tennessee. Everything was good Friday night. Everything was good Saturday. Everything was good Sunday morning. Everything was not good Sunday afternoon. Why? It was time to say goodbye to Mom and Dad. Now, my mother, of course, you could hug her. She just fit. Of course you could hug her. She was 5 foot nothing. And of course you could hug her. She just fit. She's mother. And then there's your dad. Well, what do you do with Dad? I'd never hugged him before in my life. I'm sure he hugged me when I was smaller. I honestly don't remember hugging him. I don't remember my mother and dad hugging. I'm assuming that some stuff happened because they had two kids. But I'm just telling you that I never saw them kiss until my dad was in the St. Thomas Hospital in Nashville, Tennessee. He thought he had throat cancer, and he kind of gave my mother a peck on the cheek. Why? That's the way Middle Tennessee men did that. Middle Tennessee men are tough. You know, West Kentucky men are tough. They can chew iron and spit out nails. What they can't do is learn to mourn with those who mourn. What they can't do is loosen up and soften up and understand that to be vulnerable to your wife's feelings and emotions does not mean that you are a weakling. It does not mean that you can't, you know, throw that bundle of shingles on your shoulder and go up that ladder with it and put it on the roof. It doesn't mean that you can't ride that horse anymore. It doesn't mean any of that stuff. What it does mean is you're trying to learn about mourning with those who mourn. Why? Oh, it's easy to laugh with your wife. Can you mourn with her? Do you know why she feels the way that she feels? A lot of guys, therefore, are really surprised when their wife packs up and then just leaves. And they just think, wow, man, what in the world was that about? I don't have any idea. I thought she was happy. I was bringing home money every week, as though that's going to substitute for you. Money will not substitute for you. Therefore, blessed are the mourn, for they shall be comforted. You've got to know that there are circumstances where you've got to open yourself up. That's why traditionally there are some professions like, sorry, Brother Bill, it's not true for you, but in the military, it's really tough on families. In law enforcement, it's really tough on families. In other areas, it's really tough on families. And right now, it seems that everything is tough on families. And why is that? Because the men are brought up to show no emotion, to be stoical, like in the old Tom Landry days. You couldn't tell, as coach of the Cowboys, whether or not he was winning or he was losing. You know why? He always looked the same. And there we are, until someday we lose our children and we wonder, well, what happened? One thing could be, Dad, you never let down your defenses. You never let them get close to you. Blessed are the mourn, for they shall be comforted. Why? Because if you can't sympathize with others, you can't do mission work. I'm just going to tell you, you can't. It's not worth it. There are too many adjustments to doing mission work. If you go to work somewhere else, you got to get used to there being a place where there ain't any sweet tea. And let me tell you that one thing that a Southerner will never say is, this tea's too sweet. And this summer when I was in New Zealand, I had to go for 2 weeks without a Diet Dr. Pepper. And I'm just going to tell you, now I'm kind of being facetious here, but it is different. Even if you go to an English-speaking culture, it is different when you are there. And if you cannot sympathize with them, if you cannot empathize with them, stay at home. Been to several places in South America, and I certainly don't speak their language as I would like. But my daughter does, because they live in the Dominican Republic. She speaks Spanish, and my son-in-law speaks Spanish. Well, why would you want to learn to speak Spanish? One reason is you want to get close to the people, and you know that working through a translator all the time is going to be a barrier for you getting close to people. If you want to know what they're thinking, talk to them in their language. And so, blessed are those that mourn. Why? Well, because those who grieve over the, and there's many reasons to grieve over our own sinfulness and to grieve over the sins of the world, like Jesus did in Matthew chapter 9, as he looked at the fact that there were so many people that needed the gospel, and yet there weren't that many people to preach the gospel to them. The fields were white into harvest. And so number three, blessed are the gentle. No, not gentle. I'm not gentle. You know, and so why? I'm not going to be meek. Why? Big, tall, tough elder at Campbell Street. Wound up working there. Just went there to try to didn't try out, just to preach in for a Sunday in Jackson, Tennessee. We wound up staying for 24 years. Okay, and one elder there was really imposing. Bob, I said something to you about your height tonight. One of the elders there is really imposing because of his height. Former Marine, gruff sort of guy, I thought. And he was, president of Jackson State Community College. And I thought, you know, I don't know that we're going to get along so well. This guy kind of intimidates me. So at that time, it was 1981. At that time, our oldest children, Jenny and Jill, were a lot smaller then. Matter of fact, Jenny would have been 6, and Jill would have been about 3. So this big, tall elder, you know, there at what was then the Central Church of Christ, got down in the floor and started playing with our children. And I'm thinking, you know, you might be all right. I might actually learn to like you. Why? Well, of course, there are things that you have to do in your job sometimes where you have to be tough. And there are jobs that a lot of you have, men and women, where you have to be tough. But let me give you a hint. Do not bring that attitude home. Do not do it. It will kill your marriage. If you bring that attitude home, I don't care how many wild horses you've been breaking or how many, you know, how many motorbikes or whatever else you've been riding. The point is, if you bring that attitude home with you, you are doomed for failure, not only in your marriage, but also with your relationships with those who are around you. Why? I put up all these defenses around me, and I'm tough. I'm tough. Don't talk to me. All right, and so what does this mean about being gentle? It does not mean to be meek, to be weak. It does mean to be meek. And that, what does that mean? It refers to this word about the fact that on the inside, I got all kinds of strength. You may be stronger than I am on the outside, but on the inside, I got all kinds of strength. Joyce's mother fought cancer for 15 years. She died on Christmas Day, 1998. And she fought a certain type of lymphoma. It, you know, she got rid of it, and then it came back. She got rid of it, came back. Third time when it came back, she couldn't overcome it. But one night, I think that because they were staying in our house in Jackson, Tennessee, I'm not sure about this, but I think she threw up maybe 28 or 29 times because of the real radical chemotherapy that she had. And then she just kept on going, and she kept on going, and she kept on going. She lost her hair, of course. One of the things that medicine she had, she lost her hair. And we heard her laughing one time in one of our bathrooms where she was getting ready, because she'd taken off her wig, and there was just a few scraggy little things of hair left up there, and she just laughed and laughed at herself, and she said, "I look like a witch." You know, and you think, how much strength did that woman have? Well, that's meekness. I don't have to impress you with how strong I am to be strong. And I don't have to keep drawing it to your attention. Hey, by the way, I'm strong. If somebody keeps drawing that to your attention, they're probably not so strong. But somebody with that sort of inner strength who keeps on going and keeps on going and will not give up. The night before she died, she had my brother-in-law Jim and I doing a little church service in her room there, you know. Jim was supposed to, read a certain scripture from Psalm, one of her favorite Psalms. And I was supposed to lead a song, one of her favorite songs. She's a strong woman. A lot of you women are incredibly strong because, well, you have to be. You live, many of you outlive your husbands. But it's not just because of that. It's because you just have strength. Now, what Jesus is saying there, I want you to understand how strong you can be if you have to be. I want you to understand that this is gentleness and meekness. And by the way, if I'm strong, I don't have to beat you over the head with my strength. On the other hand, you can be assured that whatever happens to me, that Jesus and I are all right. That we're okay, whatever happens to me, it's going to be all right. Therefore, these guys shall inherit the earth because they have the only real, quote-unquote, estate that there is. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. I've been to many places in the world with thanks to God helping us to be there, and I have been so impressed over the years where you can see the obvious desire for people to know who are not so chronophobic. We're kind of chronophobic here. That means time conscious. And it's time to quit. You better be through when it's time to quit. You know, and yet on the other hand, I can remember 1992 renting a hall that would seat maybe 300 people or so. It was the only one that's available in Syktyvkar, Russia. And we had it set it up for there to be a question and answer period and a lesson. I was supposed to be in charge of that and on that given during the week. And, of course, it's on the third floor. And, of course, there were no elevators. And so on the first floor, we're thinking, okay, if these were Americans, we could hear them talking by now. It was silent. On the second floor, we were thinking, this is not good. There's not going to be anybody there. There's not going to be anybody there. And so what are we going to do? We're going to have to try to think up something else, maybe try to set up another place. When we got up there on the third floor, I promise you, this is the truth. The hall that was supposed to seat 300 people or so had Russians in every seat. Russians standing on the wall. You know, standing by the wall. Standing by the wall. Seated in the front. Only there. And let me tell you, if they come and listen after not being able to hear the gospel for over 70 years since the Bolshevik Revolution, you better not preach to them for 30 minutes. Why? They want to hear. They want to know. And they start asking questions. Most nights, we start at 7. We weren't out until 10:30 or 11. Until literally you couldn't talk anymore. I've seen that happen in Nigeria with maybe a ton and a half flatbed pickup truck. There'd be 100 Nigerians. I've seen, you know, 8 or 9 Nigerians on a motorcycle. You know, they put boards out the side and ride out the side coming to the Christian lectureship in Ukpum. And I've seen them, you know, start singing at 5:30 in the morning. Why? They want to know. And we often don't, at least it doesn't look like we care. It doesn't look like we have that thirst for righteousness that people have when they know what it is that they have. But we don't seem to have that thirst for righteousness. I remember back in the 70s, the first trip we went to Israel, man, I was so wanting a hamburger and a hot dog. And when I landed in New York City, I wanted one of both. Man, I was hungering and thirsting after. I think I put a hot dog on one side of my mouth and a hamburger on the other. I was so, you know, ready, you know, for that. But there is nothing that can substitute for being with people who literally are saying to you, come on, give me some more. I want to know what the Bible says. I'm hungering and thirsting. When's the last time that we did that? Well, there's a Church of Christ every direction that you look. You know, and so there's so many around here. It's hard to hunger and thirst when it's funner to fight, you know. I mean, and so we fight each other rather than hungering and thirsting. And so, blessed are those that hunger and thirst after righteousness, they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. What does that mean? If I am a person who's very stringent in my attitude toward life and very unforgiving, the time will come when I need that and I won't have it. As a matter of fact, I may have lived my life in such a way that they had to hire pallbearers to take me out to the hearse. Why? Because I have lived in such a sorry way, in an unforgiving, an unrelenting way, that I have not put this in my life. I've not extended mercy. And by the way, extending mercy to someone is not probably somebody that you think is going to deserve it. So here's a test for you tomorrow. Somebody in your life who doesn't deserve to have mercy extended to them, do an act of mercy toward that person. The person that's causing you to have spiritual problems, the person that's standing in the way, the person that's holding you back, occupying a lot of your time before you go to sleep, do something merciful, because if you just do it for those who deserve it, well, then that's not so much mercy, is it? While we were all sinners, Christ died for us. Number six, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. That means that my heart has pure motivations. So I use this illustration. Imagine now that you have a 26-inch screen television permanently attached to your head. Okay, let's say it's 120 megahertz, 1080 and all that stuff. Okay, and so this is, it's real vivid. It's real vivid. Now, on this screen right here is every thought that you have. So tomorrow, are you going to get out of bed? Are you going to talk to your wife? Are you going to, remember, every thought that you have is right here. Every thought is right there on that screen, vividly pictured for the people that are around you so they can know what you're thinking. Uh-oh. I'm thinking I'll probably stay in my room. I'm thinking I'm not going anywhere. I'm thinking I'm going to see if I can find a surgeon. You're going to take that thing off of my head. That's what I'm thinking. Why? Because often my thoughts are not pure. And the problem that I have with that is that communicates somehow or another in the rest of my life. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God, because God is pure in heart. Number seven, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. We're going to need it. Why? Because there's enough row-row, as my dad used to say, in the church. People trying to start this and people fighting over this. You know, people doing that and people doing that. There's an old story about a guy in the pot-bellied stove days, Kentucky. There was a church there that was about to divide. And then there was a group over here and there was a group over here. And they got so mad at each other that they couldn't even share the same pile of coal. So they had to have two piles of coal outside the church because there was group A and then there was group B. And then one day, in the changing over between group A and group B, as group A was leaving and group B was coming in, there was an older man with some wisdom and stood up and said, "Brethren, there's one body and one spirit, even as you're called in one hope of your calling, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, and two piles of coal." In other words, be around the peacemakers if you can. Yes, police officers carry weapons, and they don't use them if they don't have to. The good ones, they don't. I know police officers who have retired with 25 years or 30 years of service and never shot a gun at anybody. In other words, loving peace. I really want to have peace. I want to have peace right here. I want to have peace with you. I want to have peace with God. If I have peace with God, it's going to help me with my peace with you, and it's going to help me with my peace in here. Looking inside, as your motto says on the website, and then outside, and then finally, blessed are those who are persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now, a gossip is not persecuted for the sake of righteousness. The reason why people don't want to be around a gossip is because they don't want to talk to that person, because they're going to gossip. So when a gossip wonders, why don't I have any friends? That is not persecuted for the sake of righteousness. That's persecuted because you can't keep mouth closed. That's persecuted because you're talking when you ought to be listening. On the other hand, if I am doing this like Paul and Silas singing praises at midnight, if I am doing this, Acts 16, and then I am persecuted, then I am blessed. I am blessed. So, there you are. Jesus saying to you, if you want to be a Christian, these little simple beatitudes, except they're not simple, going to make you the same on the inside as the outside, and it's a new way. It's revolutionary. Nobody taught like this. Nobody understood people like this. And that's true for us. If you want to live better and to feel better about who you are and your place in the kingdom, try one of these a week for 8 weeks. Do something to say to Jesus, you were serious, weren't you, when you said to live this way? Because I look down on the inside of me and I don't like a lot of that stuff that I see. And I'm tired of living that way. I want to live differently. Jesus, can you help me do that? I want to be better. I don't want to be bitter. I want to be better. And so, in the what is supposedly one of the simplest parts of the New Testament, there are some keys for all of us. If you'd like to make some things right tonight with God, and you need to in a public way, the time is extended now. If you're not a Christian, to be baptized tonight. If there's bitterness there that you need help with and you want help, let's pray together tonight. Whatever it is, let's believe that Jesus knows what he's doing. While we stand and sing.